Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, May 15th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI Sam Houghton and Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times. We'll check in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll hear from Mike Dean up at the State House. WCAI Sam Houghton leads us off with an overview of the latest numbers and information on the local coronavirus response. Good morning, Sam.
Morning, Steve.
Sam, another week in which the numbers seemed not to give us a real clear picture. There were some positive indications and also not so much.
Yeah, we had some of the lowest daily numbers reported around the state for the first time since March. That was early in the week. And then they started to go back up again. Part of that, I think, has to do with testing, with some of the most tests conducted yesterday in a long time. And that's only going to increase going forward. Also, the percentage of people hospitalized with coronavirus-related illnesses has dropped below 4% for the first time since the beginning of the pandemic. That really shows that a lot of people have recovered. But we also have way more cases, so that percentage, I think, is going to be skewed a little bit. But getting to the numbers here, there are 82,000 cases in Massachusetts in total and 5,500 deaths now. Locally, there are 1,119 cases on the Cape. 82 Cape residents have died. Bristol County, there are 5,400 confirmed cases and 297 deaths. Over 400 people have died in Plymouth County, and they're approaching 8,000 cases there. Still low numbers on the islands, 11 straight days on Nantucket without a new case. And then the Vineyard Hospital is reporting 23 cases on Martha's Vineyard.
Sam, you've been covering this special state election scheduled for Tuesday. This is for the Plymouth Barnstable seat, formerly occupied by Vinnie DiMacedo. Plymouth last week filed a last-minute request to push this election back. Tell us where things stand now.
Yeah, the state senate essentially did not take the advice of Plymouth selectmen, so the election is going to be held on Tuesday. A lot of people have already requested mail-in ballots, but the polls will be open. I spoke to a number of town clerks within the district, and they're still scrambling to get enough workers for the polls. Typically, volunteers are retirees, and many are understandably nervous about coronavirus. But an interesting story out of Pembroke, they actually put out a call for college and high school students to help out. They've had some success there. Also, they say if you are voting at the polls, expect lines and bring a mask, gloves, and your own pen. There's limited staff, so that you don't want to be sanitizing pens after every voter. Blue or black felt or ballpoint pens will work, but I guess don't use permanent markers or Sharpies. They will be sanitizing voting booths after each vote and only allowing a handful of people in at a time.
Also, Sam, some transportation news this week. The Cape Flyer will be running this year.
Yeah, I spoke with Tom Kerr. He tells me the train has become more and more popular each year. The Flyer, that's the train that runs from Boston to Hyannis over the summer on the weekends. They aren't starting service like they normally do on Memorial Day, but they're pushing it back to the end of June. Kerr says they typically don't have a whole lot of riders until 4th of July, aside from Memorial Day weekend. And with the coronavirus, they likely will see a lot less customers.
That is, and they're going to be, I'm sure they're going to be sanitizing those cars regularly.
Yes, they will be doing that, yes.
That is WCAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
We heard from the new reopening task force for the Cape and Islands this week. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us to talk about what plans they're putting together and other coronavirus news. Hi, Jeanette.
Good morning, Steve.
Jeanette, beach limits have been a big question on many people's minds. The task force members addressed that a little bit. What did they say?
Yes, well, I asked them how they feel about the idea of only 50% parking, because if you'll remember, the Yarmouth selectmen have said that that's going to create pandemonium and that it actually is in a draft being circulated by the state. Senator Scheer says that, you know, he didn't really want to comment on any draft. I don't think that he was familiar with the draft itself, but he just talking generally about the idea of 50% parking. He said those are really probably the kinds of limits that he would expect to see and that people are going to expect to see. The task force itself is looking at ways to help, of course, open business in a safe way. They said they're looking into additional ways to do testing when all of the summer people arrive and the visitors arrive, because there's going to be so many people coming here from all over the country and really all over the world. So,
and to be clear, they're talking about reducing the parking capacity at beaches by 50%, and another option had been that the people on the beach would have to be 12 feet between beach towels or beach setups. And again, a lot of concern about enforcing that, and the task force saying this is all draft regulations. They don't even have a sense of what this could be, but this is kind of the direction that these things are headed in. I want to ask you about offshore wind, which is something that has not been immune to impacts from the pandemic. And there are some big projects waiting to go forward south of Martha's Vineyard. You did some reporting on that this week. Tell us what you found out.
Sure. This is from the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, which is, of course, is very focused on offshore wind. Bruce Carlisle from the center says that some manufacturers in Europe have either slowed down their production or temporarily closed facilities because of the coronavirus. He doesn't necessarily see it affecting U.S. projects that are already lined up, of course, such as Mayflower Wind, but he said some manufacturers have notified the developers that there could be delays down the road because of those the slowdown there in manufacturing of the hardware itself.
And it sounds like a new organization could be forming to promote wildlife monitoring and research in relation to offshore wind.
Right. So the idea here is to create a comparable organization to what's called the Responsible Offshore Science Alliance, which is kind of a coalition of wind industry and government organizations and fishing companies focused on how wind would affect fisheries. So that's already in existence. What they're talking now is a sort of comparable one that would focus on monitoring wildlife and how wind, offshore wind turbine construction and then later operation affects wildlife.
Jeanette,
you're
kind of briefly.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. I actually want to, we'd have just a little bit of time, and I also want to ask you about unemployment, which is something you covered this week. A lot of people looking forward to Governor Baker's announcement coming on Monday about reopening the economy. But for most of the people who are dealing with unemployment now, this pain will not be over quickly. Is that right?
Right. So I spoke to Representative Crocker, who said that a lot of the calls, he's been getting hundreds and hundreds of calls, he says, from people who are trying to navigate the unemployment system. Those calls, of course, are going back a few weeks now. And he says a lot of the initial snags have been worked out for sort of the typical case person. But there are always kind of unusual cases, and some of those people are still having some issues. One thing that kind of came up in the reporting I hadn't realized is that because of this $600, extra $600 that was in the CARES Act that goes through July, it's possible that some people who've been laid off from low-wage part-time employment actually will receive more than they were earning in pay. And one woman told me there's a chance she could lose her subsidized apartment, her federally subsidized apartment, because it's very tightly income controlled. Now, it's hard to say if, you know, given that this is really unusual circumstances, how that would play out. But it's definitely difficult. I spoke to one woman on the Cape who was laid off from a full-time job on the Cape, and you know, she said it was difficult without the income, even though it was a little part of her like being home, she said, but she was the primary contributor to her household income. And that's something that, you know, the kind of the pain of losing that for 2 months isn't going to go away immediately.
WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for that.
Thanks, Steve.
A major expansion of coronavirus testing is coming to Martha's Vineyard. Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us to talk about that. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, this is a partnership with a testing laboratory. Tell us about it and what it will mean for testing on the island.
Yeah, so this is a partnership with Quest Diagnostics. Quest is, they're pretty much one of the leading private testing labs in the country and have been the leading private testing lab for coronavirus testing since the outbreak began in March. I think that they've, you know, at the high point, we're testing about 50% of all, you know, they were administering at least 50% of all the coronavirus tests in the country. So they're a major sort of player in the coronavirus testing world. But they didn't have much involvement on the Vineyard. The Vineyard currently only has one testing site. It's the hospital. And there are pretty strict criteria for who gets tested. It's basically, are you symptomatic? And even now it's been expanded a little bit to, are you a close contact of someone who is tested positive? But there's never been comprehensive testing here. And this is sort of what the plan is. And so Quest is partnering with public health officials on the island, and they're setting up this, what basically is going to be a second testing site at Martha's Vineyard High School. And the goal is to eventually open testing, or at least expand it so that it has the capacity so everyone on the Vineyard who wanted to get a test could, which, I mean, if you can imagine, is it really is a dramatic increase in sort of the capacity for testing here. And, you know, we're really lucky, quite frankly.
And part of the reason this is happening is because Quest Diagnostics has a connection with the Vineyard, not an operational connection, as you say. They don't have a lab there right now, but they have the owners. Is that right?
Right. Well, they're,
or
yeah,
the president, I guess, the chairman.
The president, yes. The chairman, president, CEO. He and his wife, Deb, this is Steve Ruskowski and his wife, Deb O'Hara Ruskowski. They're seasonal residents of Edgartown. They own a home there. And I, you know, I spoke to them briefly, and he, according to Steve, you know, he really cares about the island. And actually the genesis of this is really interesting. His landscaper is Edgartown selectman, Michael Donnaroma. And I think they kind of floated the idea by him. He's like, yeah, well, I mean, Quest is actually opening up sort of remote testing facilities across the country. And I think part of their plan is to currently, you know, they want to double the amount of testing they're even doing now, and they're doing a lot of testing. So this sort of plays into it. It's something they've done elsewhere. It's something they've done in Boston. It's something they've done in Brockton. I think that they've even partnered with something in Provincetown. So it's not necessarily unique in that sense, but it is unique that it's happening here. And it really represents this big expansion of testing, especially right as summer's coming along. And, people are, you know, inevitably going to be coming to the island. And the connection I think is just interesting too. It is on the one hand something that is coming from someone who, you know, is some resident here, you know, I think cares about the island and wants to get back in a way, but also it is sort of an operational thing by Quest. They do open these facilities elsewhere. And so it kind of fits with their model, at least this, or how they want to do testing moving forward. So I think they, you know, talking to him, they also want to expand into more rural communities as well.
We're out of time here, but I want to mention for listeners that there's a new survey that the Gazette put together. It just came out yesterday of how people are feeling about the summer. Folks should go and check it out. There was an amazing number of responses in a very short time to that survey. It's interesting what it says. That's Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Take care.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. Chatham took the unusual step this week of hosting a town-wide online forum to discuss how to handle the summer. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us now with the story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, a lot of people tuned in for this forum. Tell us about this.
Yeah, nearly 400 people logged in to participate in the forum that was held Monday. And more than 1,000 people viewed it within the next day or so on the town's channel. And many of these people who logged in had really strong opinions on how the town should approach the upcoming summer. It was clear that the town's signature events, the July 4th parade and the Friday night band concerts, won't be able to follow their traditional format. And some people at the forum thought the town should just cancel all the events, but others had suggestions for ways that they could still be held, such as having the parade perhaps go through neighborhoods or having the band concerts held at Veterans Field, which won't be hosting Cape Cod baseball leagues this summer, or games this summer, but where there's plenty of room for social distancing. The forum participants also expressed concern about crowds along downtown's narrow sidewalks, being able to maintain social distancing. And some suggested making pedestrian traffic one way on either side of Main Street downtown, while others like the idea of closing off Main Street to vehicular traffic or restricting traffic to one way in order to create space for pedestrians to move into the roadway to be able to pass each other safely.
The forum also, one of the other things people talked about was short-term summer rentals.
There was there was concern about that. Some people thought that if short-term summer rentals could be restricted, then that would keep the town from becoming too crowded. But others suggested, especially those in the industry that rent or work in hotels and motels, that that's going to really impact their livelihood, and they weren't sure how that would sit regarding upcoming state regulations as well. One person said, they urged the selectmen not to regulate us to death. That was the quote. And a lot of the businesses downtown also weren't happy with some of the proposals, suggesting that they've already had been hit by this 2-month closure, and having businesses be restricted in some way, or having traffic restricted downtown, or having the number of people coming into town restricted, was just going to hurt them further, and some of them wouldn't be able to survive that.
When I think a number of us heard about this forum, we were wondering how you're going to manage a Zoom call with 400 people on it. And our reporter who tuned in said that it was remarkably well managed. She thought it was really well done, and that people got a chance to speak and be heard, and that it didn't have a sense of a Zoom call with 12 people can feel chaotic. You can't imagine with that many people.
Sure. I think they had the advantage of having Brad Schiff as the moderator of this. He's pretty skilled at doing that. He had also moderated Chatham 365 forums last year, which were also very well. Those were live, albeit, but they were very well attended. And he was really able to keep the flow going and keep the focus on what needed to be discussed here. Nonetheless, it was a long forum. I think it lasted almost 3 hours, so everybody had a chance to give their input. And many of the suggestions, kind of hinge on Governor Baker's announcement on Monday, and the Chatham Selectmen and Board of Health are going to discuss the governor's plans, as well as the comments made at the forum when they meet on this coming Monday.
And this forum is posted online, so people can go back and take a look at it, too, is what you said.
Sure, sure. It's on the town's website and also on their YouTube channel.
That is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
For small businesses anxious to reopen, there are almost innumerable complications to sort through at the moment. From the Provincetown Independent, we're joined now by Casey Myers with the story. Good morning, Casey.
Hello, Steve. How are you doing?
Casey, I am doing well. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm glad I don't own a small business right now, I think is how I feel.
This is such a great story, and you really unpacked it. There are new rules, there are staffing questions and government programs, and then there's just the question for small businesses of who's going to show up this summer and how much will they have to spend?
Exactly. So I think there's a few big issues that Paul Benson, our reporter, really took a good look at. The payroll protection plan's forgiveness is uncertain for some seasonal businesses, for one thing. The SBA's disaster loan program seems to have fallen off the earth or into an informational black hole, and no one can really find out much about it. Then there's the new the unemployment benefits that are giving $600 a month to, is it $600 a month? Sorry, hold on one second.
An additional $600.
Yes, right, right. Basically, so that kind of is going to create competition for the businesses who might not be fully ramping up and to give full incomes to people, particularly for waiters and waitresses. This means if I'm not going to be getting a lot of tips, maybe I should just stay on unemployment. The unemployment lasts through July, so, you know, this is another thing that people are thinking about. And then, of course, there's the J-1 program and the H-2B visa programs. These are a problem for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, the lengthy amount of steps that you have to go through to get approved are being held up. Right now, the H-2B visas are held up in the U.S. Embassy, and the J-1 programs for foreign students to come and work, that's being held up by international flight. And another thing, in both cases, which are really very difficult and I haven't heard a single solution for, is the fact that many of them are crammed like sardines into inadequate housing. I've heard occupancy levels of a 2 or 3 bedroom home with 20 people in it, and this is housing provided by the sponsors of the visa, their employers, and that's obviously just not going to be very safe this year in particular. So, but Paul Benson was able to find a couple of really good solutions that I just want to mention briefly here, if I can explain it. And it's, one is the WorkShare program, which is underutilized, I think, maybe because it's just so new. But it basically goes like this. If there are 5 employees, instead of laying off one, you put all 5 at 80% hours. Then all 5 take 20% of an unemployment check, which would make up for the lost wages. And then for the duration of the year, the federal government picks up the entire tab for those benefits. So the checks won't count towards the employer's next year contribution to state unemployment insurance. And the employer is paying less, and the employee gets the extra $600 a week until July 25th, courtesy of the federal government. And that benefit, $600 a week, not a month.
$600 a week, yes.
Yes, exactly. So this benefit draws the fractional check that each employee would normally get, dwarfs the fractional check that they lose otherwise. So the WorkShare program is actually really a piece of really good news, and I'm really proud of Paul Benson for being able to explain it so well.
But there you go. One more program that small businesses have to try to figure out and unpack very quickly and implement in order to make it work for them.
Absolutely. And you're right. What you said in the beginning is also huge. How many people are actually going to show up? How many customers are going to show up? That again is a big issue in terms of how much staffing they should be looking for.
That is Casey Myers, the Provincetown Independent, with the story for us this morning. Thanks, Casey.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good day.
We have heard a lot about testing and diagnosis and fatalities when it comes to COVID-19. This week, Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times takes a closer look at what recovery looks like, and she joins us now. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning.
Cindy, a great article here. You start off by saying that we sometimes forget just how many people have recovered from this?
Yeah, the State Department of Public Health requires towns to report numbers of cases of coronavirus, but not to count recoveries. And it's interesting because there are more than 80,000 cases of COVID that have been confirmed in Massachusetts since February 1st when the state started counting, but we really don't know how many of these are active. Now, a simulator model at Massachusetts General Hospital estimates that about 6,000 cases are actually active with the infection.
So if you think about 80,000, that 80,000 number, and just 6,000 that are active, there's a lot of people who've gone through this already and are on the other side of recovery. You talked to a number of people who have done this, and one of the interesting things I thought was that there seems to be no one path for recovery for people. There's such a variety of the ways people are dealing with this.
Well, when I interviewed people who have recovered or considered recovered, I was surprised at how long it's taking, how it's not a simple process. And these are mild to moderate cases. One nurse who wasn't hospitalized at all, she recovered at home, Heather Mazur from Sandwich, and she was saying that, you know, she's out of, you know, she's back. She's, you know, past her, you know, period of being self-quarantining and took an extra week after that. But she's normally very energetic. And she said now if she, like, folds, like, a, you know, basket of laundry, she gives herself a gold star. And then I talked to two people, Kevin Lassett, he's the Sandwich High School drama coach, and Claudine Ryder from Pocasset. And they're, Kevin's in his early 50s, Claudine's in her 40s. And they were both in the hospital for several days. And neither of them needed to be intubated, so they weren't the most serious cases. But they did receive oxygen. They were very ill, and they said they are still, it's a much longer road than they expected. And Kevin said it's like a big deal to sort of walk around the block now. He used to do it 4 miles. I mean, he got out of the hospital more than a month ago, and he said it's a big deal to walk around the block, and he used to do 4 miles on the canal. It's in Claudine, and actually ended up at, I interviewed her more than a month ago, and the story ran April 9th, and she had recovered. But 19 days later, she ended up back in the hospital ER with chest pains. It turned out to be inflammation and not a heart problem, thank goodness. But she said it kind of brought up some, like, PTSD moments for her, you know what I mean? And she said she's still, you know, her building up her endurance and getting better. But she's not back to where she was before.
Yes. I mean, just talking about how long it takes some people to recover from this, you even had a piece this week about a COVID-19 patient who's discharged from Falmouth Hospital after almost 2 months.
Yeah, that was 54 days, and we haven't talked to that patient's family, but that is an incredibly long time. That's one of the very more serious cases, and we don't know how long that's going to take that person to recover. Now, the state of Massachusetts is working with the CDC to define a model for what recovery it can be considered and what it will look like. And some towns in the Cape do count recovery. Yarmouth, for instance, keeps track of who's infectious and who's recovered. And I talked to Yarmouth Health Director Bruce Murphy, and he said, yeah, public health officials are still working on this definition, but for now for Yarmouth, it includes people who have come out of isolation and not experienced symptoms for 3 days. And so, for instance, Kevin Lassen, Sandwich, when I talked to him, he said he hadn't heard from the public health nurse who was tracking his case for about 2 weeks, so he's probably, you know, considered recovered, even though he's still recovering. What will it look like? That's what people want to know. Will you be the same as you were before you got sick, and how long will that take? And then some people, like his wife, she lost her sense of taste and smell, and she's, you know, fine now. She's back. But she wasn't actually – she wasn't officially counted in the figures because they said, well, she was one of those people who were, you live with a person who has tested positive, you have some of the symptoms, self-quarantine, you know, consider yourself ill, but she's not counted in the official figures. But there are people who have these mild symptoms and who are even asymptomatic.
Mm. Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times with a look at what recovery looks like for people going through COVID-19. Cindy, thank you.
Have a great day.
Nantucket Cottage Hospital has announced it lost $1.6 million in the first month of the coronavirus. Josh Balling joins us now from the Inquirer and Mirror with that story and more from the island. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Hey, Josh, Nantucket Hospital is not alone among hospitals in reporting this kind of loss, but tell us the details here.
Sure, they certainly aren't. And Nantucket Cottage Hospital officials are saying that, as many other hospital officials are, that the cancellation of elective procedures, non-emergency surgeries, has a lot to do with that. But on Nantucket in particular, they've also seen a sharp decline in emergency room and physician visits, which led to that revenue being down $1.6 million in March alone, about 40 to 50% since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. And that, you know, although April's financials have not been released yet, they're expecting those losses to exceed even those in March. And again, like we said, elective surgeries, outpatient rehabilitation, those tend to be where the profit margins are for a lot of hospitals, including Nantucket. But what officials are saying out here is it's the general lack of volume that is most concerning, not only to the bottom line, but also to the public health. They say that they're not seeing people come into the emergency room. They're not seeing people visiting their primary care physicians. And that's perhaps indicative that they're avoiding the hospital when they really shouldn't be, and that they might be afraid that they would potentially be exposed to coronavirus if they're there. And the hospital officials are saying very clearly that all the appropriate measures are in place to take care of any patient, no matter what their diagnosis is. They have separate areas for coronavirus patients, as I think we've been talking about for almost 2 months now. Nantucket has a very, very small number of positive coronavirus cases, potentially the smallest for any community in the state, perhaps, of its size, with only 13 confirmed cases since the start of testing. And no patients currently hospitalized positive for coronavirus, and only a handful that have been hospitalized over the course of the last couple months.
A longtime Nantucket summer resident, the well-known comic actor Jerry Stiller, is being remembered by Islanders after he died this week. Tell us about Jerry Stiller and what he meant to the island community.
Jerry Stiller was a guy, and I actually knew him a little bit as well. He would come into the office with his wife, the late Ann Mara, as well, to pick up a paper from time to time over the years. And my experience seems to be what those I talked to this week had, that he was really just a down-to-earth, regular guy. He would be more than happy to stop on the street and have a conversation if you approached him, or sometimes he would even approach you and want to talk. But he was really a at the top of his field. He was an icon. He was a classically trained comedic actor who was a star of stage and screen, big and small. He was on Broadway in Hurley Burley. He was with Ann Mara on more than 40 episodes of The Ed Sullivan Show in the 60s, and he found new fame in the 90s on Seinfeld and The King of Queens. But when he was on Nantucket, he was just a regular guy. A lot of people remembered seeing him walking down to Children's Beach. The family had a house right there in nothing but a bathrobe and a bathing suit to take a morning swim before a lot of people showed up. Despite all those accomplishments, he really had the same kind of fears and self-doubts that a lot of actors do. Michael Kopko, who is the producing director of the White Heron Theater out here, used to live just down the street from and run an inn, and it related the story that's in my piece about how he said that he didn't want to talk too much or complain too much to the producers of The King of Queens because he was just an actor and might never get another job. That's the kind of guy he was, despite all those accomplishments.
That is Josh Bowling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for that.
Thank you.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Local health departments have been under unprecedented stress as they attempt to deal with the COVID pandemic. Jack Spillane of the Standard Times has a look at the workday life nowadays of the director of the New Bedford Health Department. Hi, Jack.
How you doing, Steve?
Jack, this is a nice glimpse into what's happening behind some of the news that we report regularly. Tell us about Damon Chaplin.
Well, Damon Chaplin is a very interesting guy. He's a former State Department of Public Health official who has come down to lead the New Bedford Department. And he's really had a very dynamic approach. New Bedford developed a contact tracing program early on and really converted its health department from the usual things like restaurant inspections and, triple E outbreaks to an all COVID response time all the time. New Bedford right now is up to 1,200 cases just in New Bedford, more than 40 deaths. So it's kind of been sleepy, but steadily rising and still on the upswing. And Chaplin is really credited with leading a very aggressive response team in the city. We had a story that broke just yesterday that the city is going to provide anyone who wants a mask with a mask. So they've been very proactive, and people are quite pleased with his job.
He didn't come down here just to deal with the COVID response, though. He came down here ahead of that, right? And then this was kind of thrust into his lap.
Yes. He came down to run what is a very busy health department in a city of 100,000 people, a city with a large immigrant population. A lot of that, has to do with education and as I said, things like restaurant inspections and mosquito control. But the mayor of New Bedford, John Mitchell, directed the health department to become an all COVID response team very early on. They have this contact tracing program going that has brought in the school nurses and is very aggressive. New Bedford has several thousand fewer cases than nearby Brockton, which is a city of almost the same size. So they feel it's been successful, although there also is some feeling that New Bedford may be a little bit behind in its surge because of its further distance from Boston than places like Brockton or Taunton, which have been higher. But he's a very interesting guy. And in this interview, he also talks about how stressful it's been to be working the 12, 14-hour days. He has four children, and, you know, it's a little bit bigger job than perhaps the job he signed up for.
He does talk about the leadership in the city and how the whole proactive approach, which you kind of touched on there, has really been so important to how the city has responded.
He does. Very early on, the city instructed all congregate living facilities, nursing homes, group homes, and such, that they would have to have very stringent cleaning and that they would not be allowed to have any visitors in nursing homes, and that the city would mete out substantial fines to people who were not complying. It was sort of a tough love approach, and you know, it was much more aggressive than the nearby suburbs. And the mayor said, well, you know, this is a city where people live in very tight quarters, and we don't want to happen here what has happened in other cities. And so they've been very proactive.
That is Jack Spillane speaking to us from the Standard Times. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
The transition to schooling at home has been particularly challenging for special education students and their families. George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times brings us that story. He's with us now. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, in the school environment, special needs students can receive a lot of support and very specialized support. In this pandemic time, that all shifts back to parents. And in the paper, you take a look at how some families are coping.
Yeah, this story is by Connie Berry, and she really did a great job with this because we can talk about this anecdotally all day long and understand it, but really brings to life, she talked to the parents of two students with autism, one at the high school level and the other one just a first grader. And so you can really get a sense of how this is affecting those families. And it is extremely difficult for them. These kids have been put into a situation where it's a good situation for them, where they're developing their life skills and their friendships and really integrating themselves into the school population. And then all of a sudden that's gone. And they're trying to help them as they are other students through Zoom classes. But I can attest that that's difficult for regular education students. I have two college age kids, and they had difficulty with their classes. My wife's a teacher, and I hear her upstairs trying to reach her students through Zoom. And, you know, she's doing a reasonably good job with that, but she'd much rather be in the classroom with the students. And that's true of these special needs teachers as well, as Connie spoke to them. Just a really difficult situation, and you feel for both the parents and these students. Parent of Cooper, who's the first grader, says, you know, he's used to being in that structured day. And as much as she tries to do that at home, he just doesn't understand, you know, why am I suddenly doing my schoolwork at home with you when I should be in my classroom? So it's a really good insight into how this is affecting the parents of special needs students.
It's an insight to me, I thought, looking at this article, how much the parents and the families have to pick up here to try to support these kids in this open-ended time.
Yeah, and this is while they're also dealing with everyday life, you know, their own jobs. Hopefully they still have their jobs, you know, dealing with that whole situation too. And, you know, worrying about getting infected, you know, all the worries that we all have every day, and also trying to integrate their their students into this quote-unquote new normal. It's a difficult situation, to be sure.
Let me ask you about another story you had in the paper this week. The Tisbury Select Board had an unusually large Zoom audience this week. A lot of people joined the meeting concerned about a local tennis court.
Yeah, you know, that's why I pitched this story to talk to you about, is that, you know, we started hearing about this on Tuesday. The agenda went up a couple of days earlier, but on Tuesday we started hearing about, people were concerned, what were they doing with these tennis courts in the center of the village, where a lot of residential houses around it, and people were concerned. They had heard that there was going to be a parking lot here, and so they started a petition drive, emails to the selectmen, and then 82 people show up on this Zoom meeting for the Board of Selectmen. They're lucky if they can get, you know, 15 or 20 people normally. Had it been in the Catherine Cornell Theater, which is where these meetings are usually held, they might have had to open up the balcony for this meeting, because that's how many people were interested in this topic. There was a quick pivot by the Board of Selectmen. They sent this off to two committees to look at, and they said the intention was never to turn this area into a parking lot, but they may change the use of it, maybe pickleball courts or some sort of park. But they insisted that parking lot was never part of the vocabulary here. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But interesting, even in the time of Zoom, the public can make a difference when it comes to issues like this.
And maybe even a little easier so in the time of Zoom. You don't have to leave the house to show up at the meeting.
That's
George Brennan.
And you can just connect.
Yes, and you can get home real quick. George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
A lot of discussion this week as we head closer to May 18th, the day the stay-at-home order and business closure order are set to expire from the state. Governor Charlie Baker has said repeatedly that the state will not go back to normal on Monday. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked about this and more with State House reporter Mike Dean.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Well, Mike, I feel like it's not just me. So many people have their eye toward Monday, when the governor is expected to unveil more details about how the economy will reopen and whether he will lift the stay-at-home order.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is what all eyes are on Monday, when he's going to release his four-phase plan to address reopening. Now, this is going to be basically a report from a reopening advisory board that the governor has put together, that's chaired by the lieutenant governor, that's going to make these recommendations that Baker will then order to be put in place. So the first of those four phases is going to be businesses that don't do much face-to-face, you know, a consumer-facing business. So we're not talking about restaurants and hotels and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, people can go back to work if it's easy for those businesses to take safe precautions, keep their employees socially distant from each other, and just make sure that they're doing things in the ways that we've all kind of learned to do over the last few weeks. That would be kind of phase one. Moving into phase two, which would then be other businesses kind of on a case-by-case or industry-by-industry basis, saying, okay, these are the parameters for, you know, business X or industry Y to operate safely. So now you can go and try that. There's no real indication of when that second phase will begin. It's something that, you know, even the governor himself has said that if there are spikes in transmission rates, hospitalizations, positive testing, things like that, if the virus comes back, then you could see a return to shutdowns and more kind of, you know, social distant precautions and things like that, or more closures of these businesses once they get going. So it's going to be a very, very, very cautious road that Baker is charting here.
Remind us of the data points Baker is looking at when he considers what to reopen and when.
He's really looking at hospitalization rates around the Commonwealth, as well as positive test cases, as well as deaths. And following that, the contact tracing program that Massachusetts has set up, it's the first in the nation, that's really going to take every single positive case as they come in, track that person down and find out who they have been in close contact with, and then contact those people. And this is just all in a way to let people know that they have been exposed to someone who has tested positive for COVID-19 and that they should self-quarantine for 2 weeks, whether or not they have symptoms.
The pressure, though, is mounting. There were reports this week of businesses asking for more clarity. There was even some church ministers asking for the governor to reconsider closing down religious organizations. People are anxious, I think. They're anticipating, and they're just ready to have a clearer plan.
You are seeing pressure, and it is getting media coverage. Business owners who are feeling the strain of not being open, and workers who are feeling the strain of not getting a paycheck, are certainly being vocal about this. But if you look at the population at large, there was a poll from our sister station WGBH and the Boston Globe last week that showed that the vast majority of people in Massachusetts support these precautions, and they support the way the governor has been handling this and don't want to go back. Another key indicator that a number of polls have shown is that consumer confidence at going out, going shopping, going to restaurants and theaters and things like that is not going to be sky high, at least not right away. So the people might not even be there to support these types of things. So yes, there are people who are harmed by this. You're hearing from them, and they want an effective reopening strategy. But if you look at the broader population, most people, and that goes for most lawmakers as well, are fully on board with Baker's plan.
Baker also asked lawmakers this week to pass another $1 billion in funding that will go toward fighting the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, so this is kind of some necessary spending that the state needs to do in order to get the reimbursement from FEMA, from the federal authorities. So in order to basically, you know, apply for the rebate, you know, so to speak, from FEMA, the state has to pay for this stuff to begin with. So it's a $1 billion supplemental budget right now. It's going for things like masks, that contact tracing program that I mentioned before, a lot of money to healthcare providers, caregivers, folks like that. And then once those bills are paid, then the state can go back to the feds and say, please reimburse us.
And just briefly, Mike, the Senate is considering a bill that would instruct Baker to do more about reporting public health data for some nursing homes. But that's been waiting in the legislature for some time now.
Yeah, it's become a pretty typical tiff between the House and the Senate here on this nursing home reporting. The House had their plan for it. The Senate rewrote a lot of it and combined it with a measure that would create a task force to look at healthcare disparity across the state. They passed that, sent it back to the House. The House stripped out some of it and said, no, pass the language we intended originally. So they're taking different tacks at this. There's a lot of common ground, but a lot of the details they differ on. And it looks like both the House and the Senate are digging in their heels here, and it may not get resolved anytime soon. That means it's up to the governor and the Department of Public Health to keep putting out whatever, you know, data they feel is necessary or feel is sufficient, because it looks like Democrats in the legislature aren't getting their act together enough to actually pass the bill.
And that's WCAI Statehouse reporter Mike Dean talking to us from Boston. Mike, thanks a lot.
Great to be with you.
And that is WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean at the Statehouse. That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests, WCAI's Sam Houghton and Jeanette Barnes. We heard from Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle and Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. We checked in with Cindy McCormick of the Cape Cod Times and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Mike Dean there up at the State House. A big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio making this all come together so seamlessly, and to my family for putting themselves on mute while we're on the air. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.